Today's lineup features Brenda Starr, Kristen's short story, Ukulele, and Satan. All this and more. The Flata Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flata Show. Tab for my diet. Delicious tab. Well, welcome to the Flata Show. I'm Kenty. Jose is taking a nap. And you're listening to the Flata Show. And you can reach me. I'll tell you how you can reach me. At 206-339-JOSE. That phone number is courtesy of K7.net. It's a free phone number. Get one yourself. Just call. Just go to K7.net. Get your own phone number. People can call. And when they leave a message, it will be sent to your inbox and your email. Jose is taking a nap. Let me tell you a little bit about Jose. He has been lately vacuuming the floor. What I mean is, after dinner, after he eats his dinner, and we have our dinner, we're watching TV. He goes around the entire perimeter of the living room for all night, for an hour. He'll go around sniffing and licking up the dust. He's a little vacuum cleaner. I don't know if there's something wrong with him, but he's been doing it more and more. So we have like no dust on the floor. All we have is like tongue marks from where he's licking. So I don't know if that's a good sign or not. So little Jose. Talking about Jose and me, I have made one change to my website. More is to come. But if you go to my website at www.theflatashow.com, you'll see that the main page is different. And I was telling you last week about building a little stage. Well, that's the little stage. And I set up a backdrop. And I took pictures of myself and Jose and cut it out and pasted it to cardboard to stand them up tall. So you'll see me and Jose walking into a movie theater, or not a movie theater, a theater. It looks like a old-fashioned theater box office. And that is the new theater that the Flata Show will be playing at all the time, whenever you want. That theater is, I'm going to call it the Half Moon Theater. Now, originally it was going to be called the Lazy Moon Theater, but when I was making the prop for the set to take the pictures, I wrote Half Moon Theater. So it could be Lazy Moon Theater. I mean, if you don't care, it's the same thing anyway. So the Lazy Moon Theater is the place where the Flata Show is going to be week after week. And you'll see more of the theater in future episodes and on the website. What I'm thinking about doing is building little props for the set and taking pictures of them for it'll be a surprise. Well, I'll tell you what my idea is to make the sets for different operas. Like I'll design the sets for, let's say, La Boheme or Madame Butterfly, and then I'll film it along with a recorded track from the aria. So it'll be like a sort of like a puppet theater, sort of like, I don't know. But I was thinking it'd be really great if my listeners could send in pictures of themselves. And I can tell you how big you have to be. I need full body pictures. And I'll, cut you out. I'll paste you to cardboard, cut you out, and put you in the theater and take a picture of it so you can be part of the Flata Show, especially those people that I will do interviews with again in the future, or do interviews with, I should say. That way I can have a picture of the two of us on stage, and you can, and whatever. So, okay, let's see here. As you know, I'm reading the Bible in 90 days, and the Bible in 90 days is a specially designed Bible where if you read 12 pages a day, you'll read the entire Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, in 90 days. I have just completed the Old Testament, and I started Matthew. It was it was something else. It was really great reading the Old Testament. It was really, it felt like an accomplishment having finished it. The Old Testament has a lot of repetition in it, and it has changed my view of what I think about the Bible and my theological views. I mean, I have discovered theological, my ideas about God have changed since reading the Old Testament. And that's based on the Judeo-Christian subset of religion. I think that, and it's clear to me from reading the Old Testament, that the Old Testament is God's revelation to man of God's existence, and specifically or especially revealed to the Israelites. I don't think that the Israelites are any more special than anybody else. Because in the Bible, it says about how, you know, people can know this God. I don't know what I'm saying. But anyway, that's what I think it is, the revelation of God. I'm not, I do not consider myself a born-again Christian or anything like that, or, you know, I'm not turning into a fundamentalist, so don't worry about that, my listeners. But I do recommend that if my listeners haven't done so and they feel at a loss when dealing with the world, especially with, like, this takeover of the right wing, like Christian right wing, is to read the Bible yourself to know it so you can make arguments with these people. I think that, like, for example, you know, they're against evolution, but there's nowhere in the Bible that says that that's wrong. It's a decision that they've made, like they have to believe that the earth is only 6,000 years old. These are constrictions that they put on themselves and is not in the Bible. And in fact, as I said before, there's evidence that, you know, the Bible says we evolved from animals, you know. So, you know, my experience, my religious experience has been is a lot richer now that I have read the Old Testament, and I'll let you know what I think after I read the New Testament. So, related to that, is I've had these at my work desk for a long time. Stonyfield Farm, they have this the lids to their yogurts. One was like stop global warming. The other one was win a trip to follow Darwin's path at the Galapagos Islands. And I thought to myself, suppose, like, what would that mean to, hold on, a fundamentalist Christian if they won this trip to go to the Galapagos Islands? It really would be, you know, I thought to myself, it'd be like a Christian at the Galapagos Islands, or a born-again Christian, because I consider myself Christian, but I don't consider myself a born-again Christian or a fundamentalist Christian. We'll put it there. So, anyway. Satan. Oh, yeah. Having read the first part of the New Testament, and having read all of the Old Testament, the character of Satan is also known as the devil, also known as Lucifer, goes by many names. I believe that he is God's prosecutor, and that temptation is nothing more than questioning, prosecuting you for whatever. You're right. Make sure you're righteous. I don't know. But anyway, I don't think the devil is trying. I don't think the devil has any more power than to be God's prosecutor. Okay. Let me see here. What else do I have? I have my notes here. Common area. Okay. Okay. Opera News. I have to. I got a subscription thing for Opera News. I want to do that. Last week, this past Saturday, yesterday, the Metropolitan Opera rebroadcast the Lucia di Lammermoor from the 50s with Maria Callas. as Lucia, and it's very good. Okay. Okay, I want to talk about some other gay podcasters. First, I want to give a special thanks, a shout out. And this is not to diss anybody if I forget. I mean, if I don't mention you, it doesn't mean that I'm dissing you. It's just that I want to thank Zillafag for his love. I listened to his podcast today, and he mentioned my show and how he said he likes it and loves it. So, thank you, Zillafag. I try to do a good show week after week. And, you know, sometimes I think it's really good and sometimes it's okay. And I always try to give you something good. So thank you. There's some other gay podcasters out there, which are, I think, the antithesis, maybe, of gay of the Q-Potter community. When I first started podcasting, I identify as gay, and I still do, when I had my podcast, I thought, well, I'm gonna market gay because it's gonna be from my perspective. It's not gonna be. It's gonna be what I wanted to do is clear the. Is to give voice, give myself voice, to have a voice, you know, because I didn't want. I hated it. What I hated is the media telling people how gay people thought and acted and stuff, and I just got sick of it. So I wanted to give voice to what being gay is for me, and also find like-minded people, you know, and to bring voices to the table. Stop the media. Stop the media. So anyway, I joined the Q-Potter community. And within that community, there was a self-appointed group of queer casters who took the reins and said, "We are the leaders," so to speak. I mean, of course, there's four of them: Yeast Radio with Madge Weinstein, Reagan Fox, Wanda Wisdom, and Feast of Fools. Now, Q-Potter is owned and was created by Madge Weinstein, Richard Bluestein. And he had been podcasting since, I think, 2004, the end of 2004. But he did some other stuff before that. Wanda Wisdom, I don't think she started before 2005, the beginning of 2005. And Reagan Fox, he didn't start until, like, I think it was like May of 2005. And as for Feast of Fools, I think they started around the same time as Madge Weinstein, I'm not sure. But, you know, they started early. They were the early podcasters, gay podcasters. And that's fine. You can appoint yourself or whatever. But then they had the show they put together, Eat This Hot Show, and they were, like, making fun of other queer podcasters, and, you know, it just gave me a bad taste in my mouth, because, you know, the Q-Potter was supposed to be this community where you got, you know, you went and you could talk in the forums, and under my impression was the way to booster each other, you know, help each other out, and these big podcasters, the podcast elite, with quotes, you know, they hardly, you know, helped out. Well, I mean, it's not to say they hardly, but they were very selective as to who that they were going to plug, right? For instance, I have sent tons of stuff, tons. I haven't sent tons. That's maybe too much. I have sent things to Madge Weinstein to play. And she's played a few things, but she's never mentioned my show or said thanks to Kenty at the Flata show, which I don't know why, you know. And it really, for a long time, it bothered me. And it was sort of this, it made me angry, you know, I was never sort of recognized. I don't really know why, you know. I got from things I've listened to on her show, I don't know what she thinks of me. And So right now, I really don't care what Madge Weinstein thinks of me, and I really don't care if she ever mentions me. I have to just sort of let it go, because as I'm about to say, there's a whole other group of queer casters out there, which are unrelated to Q Potter, two come to mind. One I don't like, and the other one I do like, is Johnny McGovern, the gay pimp, who I don't particularly like. He's like, I don't know, I just don't like him. I don't like his attitude. Very polished and very well produced. And I think essentially a good gay message at the same time. I don't know. There's a song he has called Gay Pimp. And he says something like, we can't get married, but that's okay. We like to fuck too much anyway. And I think that's like, for me, I don't like that. Because gay people are more than fuck machines, you know? Another one is Brini Maxwell. She does a video cast. It's a drag queen, Brini Maxwell. Very clever. She's sort of like the Martha Stewart. She does the Martha Stewart sort of thing. She cooks and does all sorts of homey things. And I love her. And I love her video cast. And I love her podcast. And she is somehow associated with NPR. So, and she's well produced too. Which brings me to the queer casters at Q Potter. Most of the Q Potters are sort of like do it yourself. So, and me included, I mean, I'm just a regular guy. I don't have access to, you know, big recording studios and stuff. And I'm sure, well, I mean, the Brini Maxwell probably doesn't either, but I guess she has more, like, her theme song is much more polished. I don't know where she got it or whatever, but I don't know what I'm saying. But anyway, I love Brini Maxwell. There's a whole other group of queer casters, gay podcasters. And so what I'm trying to do is just get away from the Q Potter mentality and, you know, be myself and, you know, fuck you. And, you know, I don't know if I'm a bitch or not, but you know what? And, you know, there's no promise at Q Potter, but I don't know. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And it's not cum. So anyway, yeah, I read this in the paper the other day. 10 things in 2006 that made us wish we weren't gay. It's from the Dig, which is a Boston magazine. It's an underground magazine. Not underground, but like, you know, your alternative magazine. It's really funny. One thing, well, it was Brokeback Mountain, which is like, yeah. Brokeback Mountain pushed back the, you know, gay rights movement, you know, 20 years. Let's see, what else was it that, gay merchandising. And they were talking about, they hate gay merchandising. You go to the gay pride parades, everything is merchandising. You know, you have the pink triangle, this pink triangle candies. And they end their little rant with, you don't see lube companies sponsoring events for the NAACP. And, you know, it's true. You know, why is it that gay events are sponsored by, you know, porn companies and lube and condoms and all that kind of crap? I mean, of course it's a part of gay life is sex, right? But it's not the only thing. You know, I mean, it makes me feel, it just makes me angry. It makes me angry, you know? It makes me angry. Okay, Sharita? Let's see here, what else I have. Oh, yeah. I went on to podcaster, what's that thing that Adam Curry's website is? Alley, no. Podcast, no. What the hell is it? K Can you help me think? You know. What the? It's 19 minutes already here. Okay. Pod show. That's it. Oh, yeah. Pod show. I told you that I signed. They somehow had my feed in there, and I didn't have ownership of it. So then I tried to gain ownership of it, and I had to go in there again. So I have, like, two feeds, two listings for the Filetis Show and Pod Show. It was Ninja was telling me about this. So I had them suck my feed. Suck my feed, Sharita. Oh. Yeah, so they sucked my feed, and they got the shows that I had, right? Then I tried to, like, upload the show after that. And you have to go through, like, 20 screens. It's like the beginning of Get Smart, you know, going through all those doors. So I was, like, finally, like, fuck this. This is not worth it. So I go on there every time, every once in a while to see if there's anything new, if it's easier to use. I mean, if it's free, you know, I'll use it. I don't care. Plus, you know, if it gets big, you know, maybe they'll pay me with their whatever. Okay, where am I sitting here? Oh, yeah. So anyway, I went on there, and I had three people in my Dig Me column. Financial Aid Podcast digs me. Sophia Ramos digs me. And the Monkey Box digs me. So if you're listening, if any of these people from the Financial Aid Podcast, Sophia Ramos and or the Monkey Box are listening to me now, thanks for digging me, but I don't know what it means. So, yeah, thank you. Also, I have an entourage. I didn't know I had an entourage, but the entourage is Cabo, Dr. Winthrop Valentine, and Balthazar. So, hi, entourage. Of course, I have a bunch of other people too, you know, like all my friends. Also, I often wanted to know who Dan J. 1953 is. It's a straight guy who loves my show, and he left a message at Podcast Alley. So, Dan J. 1953, are you listening to the Filetis Show still? And if you are, let me know. Email me. I'd be interested in hearing from you. Also, did I ever tell you on MySpace.com, David Houston, that voice guy, he did the Clerks 2 trailer. He wanted to be my friend. I don't know how he found out about my show. So David Houston, if you're listening, let me know how you found out about my show. So today's a great show, and I'm going to stop this and get on with the show.
I don't blame you for not remembering. It was months and months ago since I called you from that dreary little Harlem hotel. Sybil is a bit embarrassed about the financial arrangements. Since you've been seeing her in your practice privy, she doesn't know how she will ever repay you.
If I stand very, very erect, with a certain air of dignity, you can't tell how thin I am, can you?
I see the wheels going round and round. Why do they do that? Why do they go round and round against me?
Yes, I know, to help Sybil. Oh, I have more. I have more than Peggy. I have more than anybody.
I know everything. Every thought she thinks, everything she does, I remember. She can't remember. She mustn't remember. That's why it's very, very important that you don't tell her about us. It would be too big a shock for her. She's not ready to take it.
Yeah. That's Brenda Starry here, finishing up her scoop just for you. Brenda Starr update. It's been a while. And is it getting exciting? Exciting, exciting. Just wait till you hear all of the... Is that B.O.? No. It smells like B.O., but I don't know what it's from. Well, the last time, Mike Mooney was drunk and confesses to Brenda that he killed Darth Fable. Brenda says, wait 1 minute, I'll help you. So she sends him to a lawyer, and while he's at the lawyer's office shooting the shit, she's searching his room for the Oscar statuette that killed Darth Fable, and she doesn't find it. But she does find a photo album and gets a new lead. She finds Betty Snopes. And this woman, Betty Snopes, is the same woman who is in a photo in Teen Titans' office. And apparently, that woman is supposed to be her dead mother. So Brenda's like, sure she's dead, because she finds a recent letter sent to an envelope sent to Mike Mooney from Betty Snopes, and there's a P.O. box. So she leaves Mike's and goes to the post office. And while she's driving, she quips, "If more people drove on empty roads singing, there'd be less need for therapy." Which is, I like sometimes driving on an empty road or back roads. The John's probably thinking, "You don't like the drive." It's true, I don't like the drive sometimes, especially when it's like bad weather. But when it's perfect weather, I like the drive. No traffic and perfect weather is fine for me for driving. But if it's raining or snowing or whatever, forget it. So anyway, Brenda drives to the post office and finds Betty's address, and she schmoozes with the United States Postal Service worker and finds out through conversation. Pardon me. I just took a little nap and I'm tired. I'm having some tea. And she finds that Betty is a bathroom attendant at Celebrity Circus, which is, I guess, some sort of casino or whatever. A place where celebrities go. And Brenda finds Betty and shows her the photo, which has the photo. In the photo is Betty, Darth, Fable, Lula, and Mike. And Betty's like, "Oh, yes, that is me." Betty learns that Teen Titan, the movie mogul, is alive. But Betty confesses that, "Yes, I raised her, but I did not give birth to her." So Brenda's like, "What?" So Betty tells Brenda that Tina is Lula's child. And Brenda's like, "But wait, Sherita, Lula had a boy." And Brenda lights up a cigarette. "Honey, you want a cigarette?" And Brenda says no. And she goes, "Listen, I'll tell you what. Tina was Lula's child who was fathered by Mike Mooney." And Brenda's like, Brenda Starr is like, "Scandalous." So we find out that Darth, who is a big gay, okay, had his career was basically... His career is basically positioned on Lula. You know, him and Lula were an item, and that's why he had a career, was because of Lula, not because of himself. And he's also a big gay, okay? So we find out that Darth, when the baby was born, he could see that the baby wasn't his. So what he did, while Lula was still unconscious, what he did is take the baby... He paid off the doctor to tell Lula that it was a boy, and then gave the baby to Betty Snopes to raise. And so no one would ever find out that Lula had a child with Mike Mooney, because it would have looked bad for Darth and his career would have been ruined. As it turns out, they're just forgotten stars anyway. I mean, Darth Fable is living on Skid Row, and Mike Mooney living like an old retirement home. No one remembers them. And so who knows, you know? You know, just pettiness, really. So let's say here, where are we? So yeah. The baby. Betty returns to work. Okay, so she tells him the story. Betty returns to work, and Brenda... says, "But I have more questions." And she goes, "Well, good luck, Sherita. I have to get back to work." So Brenda goes to Lula's mansion. Remember, she was thrown out previously. So she goes to the mansion, and while looking for evidence to try to tie Jig in with trying to kill Lula, she's trying to She's trying to. She knows that Jig has done is responsible for Lula, because you remember Lula fell ill after celebrating with Jig on his new job with Teen Titan. Okay. So she's looking around the house trying to find evidence that Jig tried to kill Lula, and Patch comes along. Patch is her dog, who has a patch on his eye, and looks like he's playing with a bone, and it's the Oscar statuette that killed Darth Fable. It's Darth Fable's Oscar. So Brenda calls Spiff and says, "Listen, Spiff, I think that Jig may have killed Darth Fable," and explains the statuette. And Spiff is cute. He calls Brenda Starr Jaquita. Now remember, Spiff is gay, openly gay. He's a little too gay, but that's okay. But he's a gay character in the Brenda Starr series, because he wasn't in the last. He was in the when I first started podcasting. That's when he was on, and I like the way he calls her Jaquita. So because I say Sharita, but you know, I don't know. I've been saying Sharita, but I also call people Taffy and Baby Doe. So I don't know. It's just, you know, for fun. Okay, Sharita, let me get on here. Sharita is the hypothetical other. So Jig is dry. Okay, so Brenda calls Spiff and says, "I think Jig killed Darth Fable." Now, at this time, Jig is driving back to the mansion. So while Brenda is talking to Spiff on the phone, she's in near the pool on a chair. You see somebody sneaking up behind her with a rope. It goes around her neck. And the phone, you hear Spiff saying, "I think we got a bad connection." So the next panel, we find that Brenda is tied up, and it's Jig. Jig had returned and found her and tied her up, and then starts threatening to kill her, saying, "I've been waiting to do this a long time, Brenda Starr, you busybody. Nosing around in my business, you bitch. I can't wait to kill you." And Brenda said, like, "Well, you must have killed, you know, why'd you try to kill Lula and Darth?" And he goes, "Well, you know, I could have given her a stroke with the way I look. I'm God's gift to women. You know, it's funny she didn't have a stroke when I was giving it to her. But a little poison in the champagne didn't hurt. But the old tough bird wasn't enough for the old tough bird." And then he explains about Darth Fable, that he arrived. Yeah, Mike Mooney and Darth had a fight, and Mike Mooney knocked Darth out. And I guess Darth appeared to be dead, but he wasn't. And Jig arrived, and Darth is like, "Help me, Jig, help me." But Jig puts his foot on the old guy's chest, Darth's chest, and kills him, bludgeons him to death. So while this is going on, Spiff arrives at the mansion. And he's like, "Brenda, Brenda." And then you see Jig has heard him. Next scene is Spiff is tied up next to Brenda. And he's like, "Sorry." So the last panel I'm going to read to you. So they're on the mansion is on a cliff near an ocean. And Brenda says, "If I have to die, I'm glad it's with a friend, Spiff." And Spiff replies, "Me too, Jaquita." Now they're tied up in a car. And the car is pointing towards the cliff, okay? And so Spiff continues, "You were always the only girl for me." And then Jig says, "An Oscar is a useless object, really worth less than a pair of toenail clippers. And someone else's Oscar, well, that's worth less than a baby's toenails." So Spiff says, "Are you praying, Jaquita?" And Brenda has her eyes closed, right? And she goes, "Yes, the prayer all reporters say on the verge of death. Please, God, let my obit make the New York Times." It's kind of funny. So we see the next panel is Brenda is tied up, right? She's in the driver's seat. Jig is leaning over and putting the car into neutral, I guess, or drive. And he says, "Now let's get the scene moving." And in the rearview mirror, you see Patch. Okay? and he goes, put the pedal to the metal, and he leans the heavy, the Oscar statuette against the gas pedal. And then he says, the last panel says, and let the final credits roll. And you see the car moving towards the edge of the cliff. And on the side, Patch is saying, arf, arf. And that's all for Brenda Starr. You know, I'm going to have to update this a little bit more, a little sooner, because it's exciting. I can't wait to find out what happens to Brenda. Well, kiddies, since I didn't do the show last week, I had done actually recorded the Brenda Starr. So now I can tell you what happens this past week. It's very exciting. So, as you know, Jig is trying to kill Brenda and Spiff. He tied him up, put him into a car, and then he stuck Darth's Oscar on the gas pedal, and the car is accelerating to a cliff where it will kill Spiff and Brenda Starr. You see Patch, Brenda's dog, in the back chasing after the car, saying "arf, arf," and it says this is the second time Jig has used Darth's Oscar as a murder weapon. Okay, so then we have. Okay, let's see here. I want to read it because it's really good because I read it this week. It says here, I've always wondered what people think on the verge of death. And what are you thinking about, Chiquita? That's Brenda Starr. And she's saying, I should have gone traveling more and not put all my money and all that money into the 401k. And what are your thoughts on dying, Spiff? No time for reflection, dude. Death is breaking news. I'm thinking I should have been more myself when I had the chance. This is what they're thinking of as the car is speeding towards the cliff. One good thing about dying, Chiquita, I'll never have to listen to another barking dog. And that, of course, they're referring to Patch. And he has a patch on. And then But this dog's more than bark, it says. And the dog jumps. And Patch to the rescue. He takes the Oscar off the gas pedal and then sits on the brake. Isn't that cute? That's cute. So now we have Patch have saved them. But can Wonder Dog untie the knot? So they're still tied up, but the car isn't going over the cliff. Okay, so what we have here is you see Spiff calling the police, reporting an attempted double murder. And then you see Brenda wrestling Jig to the ground. And he's going, let me go, Brenda. We'll split Lulu's fortune. I'll split Lulu's fortune with you. Brenda says, Jig, you're a lousy actor. And hold on. But you were made for Hollywood. You're all hustling, bad dialogue. So meanwhile, Spiff is still calling the police. Yes, that's right, officer. The dog leaped into the car as it sped toward the cliff. He shoved the Oscar statuette off the gas pedal, then pressed on the brake. Yes, you heard me right, an Oscar. And then you see a picture of Patch going, growling, because he's growling at Jig. Because Jig's a bad guy. So then, then he gnawed our ropes off and captured the bad guys. That's what Patch has done. No, this is not a crank call. You know, nothing's too crazy for L.A. The last panel is Jig is being taken into a police car. He's all, you know, handcuffed. So that's the end of this adventure. That's the third one I've done. We did the end of... one, I forget, the one where the old woman was trying to kill Brenda Starr with poisoned cookies. And then the last one with the chef, Rock, remember Rock? Chef Rock, he tried to kill her by setting her on fire in the kitchen on wheels. So anyway, that's it for Brenda Starr. Update will be coming in.
Once I met a happy little bluebird. I was just as blue as I could be. began to smile when he sang this merry song to me. Just let a smile be your umbrella on a rainy, rainy day. And if your sweetie cries, just tell her that a smile will always pay. Whenever skies are gray, don't worry or fret. A smile will bring the sunshine and you'll never get wet. So let a smile be your umbrella on a rainy, rainy day. As I listened to that happy bluebird, I soon learned his smart philosophy. On my windowsill, he began to trill. This is what he had to say to me. Just let a smile be your umbrella on a rainy, rainy day. And if your sweetie cries, just tell her that a smile will always pay. Whenever skies are gray, don't worry or fret. A smile will bring the sunshine, and you'll never get wet. So let a smile be your umbrella on a rainy, rainy day.
I'm going to read a short story I received from Kristen Oblivion. She said she offered this up. For the latest show, remember I was calling for acts, and this act is from Kristen Oblivion. It's a short story called Journey of the Oak Tree. I'm going to do my best to read it. Closing the door behind him, Carpule sat in the soft, thick grass outside of his home to watch a marmalade-setting sun. Under the horizon, the soft-lit beam seemed to pass through him quietly. He closed his eyes and dreamt of where he was and how he came to such a marvelous place as the home that he lived in. He felt at one with the celestial ball as he watched the sky turn violet and blue like a kid's cartoon. Tomorrow his journey would begin, and the sun would seem foreign as it set in the evening. His bags patiently and promptly packed the day before, he was ready. Not one for sentiment, he gathered his things and walked to the bus stop 4 hours before his plane was due for departure from Dallas to Miami, then to Africa, and finally India, where he was due for a 3-week stay for his studies in anthropology. He was anxious and waiting as he watched his house from the bus stop and hoped that it would be well looked by the guest house sitters due to arrive that evening, prearranged, of course, far in advance. That was so common of Carpule's nature. The bus was early, but it mightn't have seemed so to him if he hadn't looked at his watch as he saw the bus passing over the shallow hill. Before poking down the street with cool tinted windows and smooth-sounding engine, he boarded the bus with a display that made others notice, lugging two brown, odd-sized suitcases that looked like something from a 70s police drama and his tan Swiss Army backpack from a nature documentary. In that very instant, he filled part of his self-prescribed role with a cheap fedora and closely shaven face, as he almost hummed a tune from his favorite film, closing his eyes to rest before the long wait at the airport. The bus was so much cheaper than a taxi, and to him it seemed more adventurous, and Carpule so much longed for a self-made adventure. That Renaissance man operandi that he admired in others, whose qualities seemed to elude him with a dedication that he could never quite grasp outside of his romantically lain plans for his future. Checking his bags at the airport, he looked out the window of the gate as his plane docked and everyone boarded. He watched the skyline of downtown Dallas as it struck him that he was really leaving and going a long way from home. The plane took off the runway and tilted upward, with the city still in sight of his passenger's window. He felt a brush of what could almost be described as cold feet. Would he actually make it to India? The Atlantic seemed so big and so deep. He was still overlooking the United States that had always seemed without end. Carpule had never left America and was scared, though he made no mention of it in his journal. He landed in Miami in mere hours and was amazed at how small the world had become with air travel, a private contemplation riddled in pretense and that preceded his age as a young graduate student. He remembered a trip to Eureka Springs, Arkansas as a boy that took longer in his grandmother's car than this plane had taken to the edge of his homeland. With little delay, he departed from Miami. That evening, he watched the amber sunset while flying over the ocean and reflected that it was the same sun that shone on him yesterday. He remembered that it was the same sun that had shined on him always and felt close to home again. He realized that the sun would be his friend and constant companion for his entire journey. It would rise each morning, regardless of whether he did, as it had through the ages. It was the sun that had shone on a thousand yesterdays, that shined on the first animals and the first man and woman. It cast its light onto Moses and onto Christ. It guided Napoleon as he longed for conquest, and it brought light to Columbus in his voyage near the lands that Carpule had just left. The sun that he felt had been his belonged to everyone, and unto itself as an eternal candle of humanity. What had the proverbial eyes of the sun seen that wasn't known, and it wasn't telling? Carpule then understood how an early clan of people might worship it, and he wondered if he, perhaps, gave it the same respect. The jet landed near the African coast at an airport in Cape Town that seemed nothing like his pictured idea of the African plains. The layover was a night stop, and Carpule slept in a hotel several miles from the airport via shuttle van. Even in the absence of his PBS inclinations for Africa within this urban metropolis, he noted how fertile the land was, even in the city. Under a darkened sky, the grass seemed almost greener in the shaded patches by the roadside. The shuttle passed over a wide river with abundant majesty, even in those twilight hours, as the lights of the ships below a high suspension bridge and wind sailed past and shook the van and rode a bit. The next morning, Carpule would take a picture as he passed over it again on his way to catch the early plane that would fly him to Johannesburg and eventually India. It was hard for him to believe that yesterday morning he was in Dallas, making his way to the bus stop, bidding his home farewell for a transglobal retreat. But this was only a business trip, he thought, and he smiled to himself faintly. The trip into Bombay was a bit rougher than the voyage over the Atlantic. The turbulence over the Indian Ocean and the heat of the desert couldn't be completely concealed in the air-conditioned fuselage. Now, from the airport, after a landing that seemed too abrupt to have been planned, Carpule could see a distant mountain range with white caps that blended perfectly with the clear blue sky, which looked like floating clouds of snow from a still morning reverie. But it was in the city of Agra where he saw the huge palaces and street vendors. Here was the dream he had of the picturesque India, like the action films and documentaries he had watched his whole life. And he noted in his journal that the cows actually roamed the streets he had hoped. His work here was with the university in a small section to the north, where some of the villagers lived in close quarters as one family sharing everything. Carpule was enchanted by how they seemed to rarely quarrel, as he wondered whether having so little was a blessing to them. Yet, from the intangible perspective of their own little world, They had so much to give and share with each other as they did. On the two occasions of spats that he documented, Carpuhl expressed a deep admiration in his report for how incidents were quickly resolved and taken seriously, as the entire family became an instant courtroom, and their elders, so respected and highly revered, often made the final judgments, which were not only accepted by both parties involved in the opposition, but in fact, each seemed to display a degree of lifted anxiety that bore no grudge. He was saddened when the 3 weeks had ended with thoughts of his going home. He had learned so much in the short time that he left the marginally humble existence of his Dallas residence. He gathered the family together for a final snapshot, with him standing near a large tree by their home. But he couldn't hide the sadness in his eyes as the camera snapped the last picture. From the villager's paradigm, he was a rich man, but Carpuhl knew this long before his departure, as certain as the tears in his reflective smile. The trip home seemed smoother as his nerves were calmed and his anxiety had disappeared with the initial plane ride over the Atlantic. He wondered whether the Bermuda Triangle stories had any significance as he jotted in his journal in the plane near Miami that his former fears seemed to have been sucked into another dimension that were now so far removed. He loosened his wits and took a cab home from the Dallas airport, where he found his little house well cared for, and he would later write in his journal that the grass in his lawn in that instant was comparable to the grass in Africa with its brilliant shade and softness. His pictures the next day would make it all seem so real again, and he wondered what the family was doing as he calculated the time in India, as he took his pictures outside with him to watch the setting sun. But these pictures were only in his imagination, as the whole trip had been for the past 3 weeks of his still, quiet life. The imaginary picture of the palace was to his left. That was the modest home that he was so satisfied. To his right was the picture of a huge and awing river that was the street that he lived on. Before him was the golden sun that was his constant companion, and near him was the oak tree in his lawn that was the picture of the family that he knew must live somewhere. Carpuhl had a wonderful imagination, and that night he wrote in his journal about the journey of the oak tree. 13th of March, 1981. Today, watching the sunset, I could see the whole world from where I was standing. Kristen, that's a wonderful short story. For those interested in contacting Kristen Oblivion, come to MySpace. Come to MySpace and look for Kristen, and you can contact her through there. And that's myspace.com/flatishshow. Links are on the web or my blog.
From my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual site of the building that's crashed in. And as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon and then caused the side to collapse. Now, even though if you look at the pictures of the Pentagon, you see that the floors have all collapsed. That didn't happen immediately. It wasn't until almost about 45 minutes later that the structure was weakened enough that all of the floors collapsed.
Everything went wrong, and the whole day long I'd feel so blue. For the longest while I'd forget to smile, then I met you.
past. I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand always, always. Days may not be fair, always. That's when I'll be there, always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always. Dreams will all come true, growing old with you, and time will fly. Each day more than the day before, till spring rolls by. Then when the springtime has gone, then will my love linger on. I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand always, always. Days may not be fair always. That's when I'll be there always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always.
The Woodpile by Robert Frost, from his collection of poems, North of Boston. Out walking in the frozen swamp one gray day, I paused and said, I will turn back from here. No, I will go on farther, and we shall see. The hard snow held me, save where now and then one foot went down. The view was all in lines, straight up and down, of tall, slim trees, too much alike to mark or name a place by, so as to say for certain I was here, or somewhere else. I was just far from home. A small bird flew before me. He was careful to put a tree between us when he lighted, and say no word to tell me who he was. Who was so foolish as to think what he thought? He thought that I was after him for a feather, the white one in his tail, like one who takes everything said as personal to himself. One flight out sideways would have undeceived him. And then there was a pile of wood for which I forgot him and let his little fear carry him off the way I might have gone, without so much as wishing him good night. He went behind it to make his last stand. It was a cord of maple, cut and split, and piled and measured 4 by 4 by 8, and not another like it could I see. No runner tracks in this year's snow looped near it, and it was older sure than this year's cutting, or even last year's, or the years before. The wood was gray, and the bark warping off it, and the pile somewhat sunken. Clematis had wound strings round and round it like a bundle. What held it, though, on one side was a tree, still growing, and on one side a stake and a prop, these latter about to fall. I thought that only someone who lived in turning to fresh tasks could so forget his handiwork on which he spent himself the labor of his axe, and leave it there, far from a useful fireplace, to warm the frozen swamp as best it could with the slow, smokeless burning of decay. You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at Kenty@theflatusshow.com.